Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the acclaimed biologist, author, cancer survivor, and environmental advocate, Sandra Steingraber. Steingraber has been writing about climate change, ecology, and the links between our health and the environment for many years. She has also been speaking out against fracking and practicing civil disobedience against methane gas storage along Seneca Lake. She is the author of three highly acclaimed books, including Living Downstream, an ecologist's personal investigation of cancer and the environment. And welcome back to the show, Sandra.
Thanks for having me, Tish.
Now, the excitement has just exploded this week. We got word that fracking is not going to be allowed in New York State. Talk to us about your first thoughts when you heard this.
December 17th is Victory Over Fracking Day in New York State. So I think we were all surprised. Certainly in the days leading up to the cabinet meeting, we were hearing rumors that there may be an announcement about the Department of Health study, but we didn't think that the governor's own pronouncement about that study would come on the same day. But then as it became clear that the cabinet address was going to be televised and it looked like an announcement was forthcoming, everyone by the morning of December 17th was on red alert.
It's amazing.
So for me, the day was surreal because I was participating in a civil disobedience action of the same day. This one, and this is all out at Seneca Lake, and this one was led by musicians, including some of our finest singer-songwriters, including Richie Stearns, probably the American's finest banjo player, and his partner, Rosie Newton, on the fiddle. We had Irish folk singers, and we had the Sim Redman band drummer, and Donna the Buffalo, and so on. And so when those guys blockade, they perform, they dance and sing. And so that had all happened. And then they were all in jail being processed while all of a sudden it was clear that this was coming down. So I was outside of a jail watching on my cell phone the proceedings. And I began to hear the Department of Health commissioner recite the findings of some of the studies I know very well as a biologist. In fact, I had just summarized those at a press conference the week prior in Albany. And the conclusions he was reaching, one study after another, as he laid them out in this PowerPoint presentation of data in a cabinet meeting, which I had never seen, you know, public health data, which is my stock and trade, be the centerpiece of a cabinet meeting the executive level of any, you know, executive office. It was just an amazing moment, and it became clear to me then when he said that I would not feel comfortable living with my family near a drilling and fracking site, that we had won.
Oh, that was a most powerful statement. That's one they keep playing over and over
again.
That was an amazing statement.
Well, it just shows the power of personal autobiography combined with data, you know. So when somebody who is a physician says that this, as a doctor, I would not do this, then the next sentence is, and the governor was very clear on this, well, if you would not live with your family there, then you can't recommend that any New Yorker live with their family there. Otherwise, it would be negligence, right? Because we have equal protection for everyone. And so it was an affirmation of democracy.
Oh,
it was an affirmation of science.
And it was a vindication for you. You've been talking about the health aspects of this for years.
Well, vindication for the whole, for so many of us.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
The anti-fracking movement is like an opera, I think. It has a cast of thousands, and everyone brought their own skill sets and their own knowledge base. You know, there are economic arguments against fracking as well.
Oh, yeah.
And those also came into play at various points. It just so happened that in the denouement, the spotlight was on health, which happened to be what I've been looking at these many years.
And I want to bring that up because let's talk a little bit for people who might not know your biography about the way you began your career. You started investigating the environment after being diagnosed with bladder cancer at the age of 20,
right.
And you suspected that it might be in the water in your hometown. Talk to us about that.
Well, I was 20, so I was in between my sophomore and junior years of college and was, I think, planning a career in medical school. I mean, that's what everybody I ran around with was doing. Mm. And I was very good at animal surgery. You know, if you knew a rat who needed a tracheotomy, I would have been your girl. And then after this diagnosis, I realized a couple of things. One, I didn't want a hospital to be my workplace anymore. Mm. But also, the questions my own diagnosing physician asked me about what my environmental exposures had been as a child led me to believe that the answer to that question that all cancer patients ask, which is why me, that for me the answer would be found in an understanding of my ecological roots. But it wasn't until many years later, because bladder cancer is a cancer that of all human cancers recurs most often, recurs in 70% of all patients. So you one leads a very highly medicalized life. So it's in and out of the hospital every 3 months, right?
Yep.
And so it really wasn't until I was past my PhD and had a nice postdoc at Harvard Radcliffe that I decided to go back to my hometown and become a kind of ecological detective there. And I did uncover the presence of certain kinds of bladder carcinogens in the drinking water wells. I also discovered that I was just one data point in a whole cluster of cancers there. So that story, as well as the statistical story about the link between environment and cancer, became the subject of my book, Living Downstream. And that's, you know, the first iteration of that book came out in 1997. And so I've been involved in environmental health and public health issues for a lot of years. So when we first understood that fracking had its maybe coming to New York, that the gas industry had us in its sights, I woke up to it like everyone did when I discovered that the land around my little house was surrounded by land that had been leased to the gas industry, and that, in fact, 40% of the land in Tompkins County was already so leased, and that absent our intervention, this was going to become an extraction colony for the fossil fuel industry. Little, you know, Finger Lakes region where we have all these kind of alternative visions and all kinds of...
Sustainable,
we're an incubator for all kinds of ideas.
Absolutely,
right.
Sustainable food and organic.
So I felt like there was an army massing on our southern border and that we were going to be occupied and that we needed to immediately create a resistance movement of some kind. And so people brought their own skill sets and their own knowledge base. And for me, I'm a pretty good organic chemist. I can read the public health literature. So I felt like what I could offer this was the ability to read about what we knew about the risks and harms of fracking and then translate that into plain spoken English to equip the citizenry as well as to remind our elected officials and our regulatory agencies that they had an obligation to protect us.
And at
the time, of course, there was only a very slim file folder full of data. I mean, and when this all started in 2009, I think there were between 6 and 12 studies that had been published on the environmental and health effects of fracking.
You know, I was going to ask you that, too. Did you have to wait and see what was going to happen with fracking? I mean, where it had already been begun, you know, in Pennsylvania and stuff, to see exactly what the health risks were?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and the problem was that science had one hand tied behind its back because this industry surrounds itself by secrecies of all kinds.
Don't know what kind of chemicals they're using, right?
That's one. They don't disclose their chemicals. So how can you begin to say, are these exposures leading to health risk when you don't know what the exposures are? And then the other is that the very typically in the leases that the industry signs with landowners, there are non-disclosure agreements. So if your well water should go bad, if you want replacement water, you can't tell anyone what happened to your water, including your neighbor, including your doctor, including the press. And so for researchers who then did go in to try to piece this together and just to begin by talking to people where there were rumors that water had been contaminated, people would openly tell, you know, scientists that they couldn't speak to them.
God, that's amazing. So it's amazing, you know, the information got out.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard enough to do public health research, to try to piece together what might have happened to people when they were exposed, figure out if they have higher disease rates because people move into an area, they move out of an area. You know, these aren't we don't do controlled experiments on people. Thankfully, it would be unethical. Mm-hmm. So then we have to look at unnatural accidents, right?
Yeah. And they called it anecdotal too, right? I mean,
well, they called it, and sometimes it was, right? But the anecdotes are often clues for further inquiry. They are hypothesis generating. It was anecdotes that told us that children who had been exposed to lead paint had learning problems. Yeah. It was anecdotes that told us that women whose mothers took DES during pregnancy had higher rates of vaginal cancer. Yeah. So doctors would listen to these anecdotes. And then at some point, we always learned in graduate school, the plural of anecdote is not data. And that's right. But the plural of anecdotes is a hypothesis.
Yeah, yeah.
And then from there, you design a study and go forward. It's just that with fracking and all this enforced secrecy, it was really hard to go forward. Well, we managed to go forward anyway, and the science started to come in. So, well, the first iteration of the ESGIS, this environmental impact statement, was generated, we had less than 100 studies. Now we have four times as many studies. Mm. We have 414 studies at last count. The data on fracking is very young, but it's like little arrows that all point in the same direction. Yeah, the overwhelming number of those 414 peer-reviewed scientific studies on risks and harms of fracking show risks and harms. You know, if you look at the data on air pollution, 90-some percent of studies that look at air pollution found it. If you look at water contamination, 72% of all studies that looked at water contamination found either overt signs of contamination or clear risks that it was going to happen. And same thing with actual health. So what we're missing, and it was really interesting to me that Dr. Zucker, the DOH commissioner, actually pointed this out right in the cabinet meeting. What we're missing are these longitudinal studies over time where we follow people who live near drilling and fracking operations and we see what happens to them. Do they have more leukemias? Do they have trouble with fertility? Do they have more learning disabilities in their children and so on? Those would take years to learn.
And then we still are going to be able to, unfortunately, look into this because Pennsylvania is still allowing it in other states.
Right.
California.
Right. Yeah. And that has always been our argument is, look, we're already doing it in all these other states. If you want to know the risks and harms in fracking, we don't need to replicate that experiment here in New York. Let's push the pause button here and be in the control group, and then let's take a close look at what's going on in other states. But there's such a hostile environment, even in some of our research colleagues in Colorado who are trying to investigate. You know, they had to actually suspend their studies once they found frightening-looking health effects. I mean, they were worried about getting defunded. They were...
Wow.
You know, I've spoken in the Midwest on fracking and was contacted by one of our finest researchers who's actually doing some of the best research on the health impacts of fracking, who said, I can't even show up at your lecture. I can't be seen, but let's go have lunch, and I want to tell you what I'm doing. And, you know, there's so much sort of just real outright persecution. I've never seen anything like that, actually.
Oh, that's, well, money, it has to do with money and greed, as far as I can tell. Let's talk a little bit about what's next for Sandra Steingraber. I know this issue is still going to have some need for vigilance, you know, but you've also been working against methane gas storage on Seneca Lake. You've been doing civil disobedience. Tell us a little bit more about what's your next action.
Well, I sure will. I mean, I have to say, this is a time, really, to make sure that we fully appreciate what we've done before we, like, race off to the next battle and offer real gratitude. And I want to be really clear about that I am intensely grateful to Governor Cuomo. He's the only governor who has stood up to the oil and gas industry. I mean, think about what that means.
Oh, it's amazing.
Our bedrock underneath New York happens to be full of bubbles of methane. They've been there for 400 million years. We never knew how to get them out. Along comes this brutal, primitive technology called fracking, which basically blows it all up and uses poisonous chemicals to kind of get those bubbles out. And we're the first state that sits over a lot of those bubbles that says, you know what, we're going to leave this in the ground and we're going to find another way forward. And the governor is, I think, for all signals that I can read, really interested in using New York as a showcase for renewable energy. And he said that very clearly in that cabinet meeting when he said, you know, nobody likes fracking, but they see it as the only form of economic development. And what we need to do now is find a kind of clean economic development for our impoverished areas. I take that as a personal challenge.
Oh,
so
I'm
responding to the governor's call.
Sure.
You know, that's my next project, right, is to ensure that New York remains out front. I mean, it's almost like we're going to raise that, Statue of Liberty lamp by the Golden Door, only this time it's closing the door on dirty fossil fuels, which is killing our children and killing the planet, and finding a new way forward. And all of a sudden, by closing the door on fracking, we sort of rescue the hostage, right, which is renewable energy and sustainable development. And now we can be the laboratory, if you will, or the incubator for these new ideas for the rest of the world. I can't imagine living in a more exciting time right now. I feel so lucky to be in this place.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. Now we can speak from a place where we want to make real change.
Right.
You know, because the complaint was, what do you do?
Right.
We need energy. If you're just joining us, my guest is biologist and environmental advocate Sandra Steingraber. Talk to us a little bit about climate change, because you are considered, you know, the translator between science and the layperson.
Sure.
And why do you think so many people still will not believe there's such thing as climate change?
I actually think they do now. I mean, I think we've moved from outright climate denial.
But we still see it in our government.
Well, there's a few holdovers, right? But that's, you know, they're in the pocket of the oil and gas industry for the most part. But I think most folks who aren't getting checks from the oil and gas industry are not in climate denial so much as they are in climate helplessness. They think there must be a problem. I mean, they can see the signs of it all around them, that we're having, you know, weather we've never had before. Bees are disappearing. I mean, it's become empirical now, not just something that will happen in future generations. And so that's I pretty much try to keep my ear to the track of what public opinion is on these things. And I do think people see it. They just don't know what to do.
They feel helpless.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I had an insight about all this when I was in jail. So
I want to talk to you about being in jail.
Well, I'll talk about climate change from within my jail cell, actually, because so leaving aside the reason that got me to jail, I was in jail recently. And it just so happened that in my particular cell block, other than the other civil disobedient who was in the cell next to me, all the other women were addicts, and they were part of, you know, the methamphetamine industry, and they were all detoxing in their cells and having withdrawal. I was going through caffeine withdrawal because there's no caffeine, there's no coffee in jail. So we were all just withdrawing there in cell box 3D. You know, and then it turns out that all of the women that I was incarcerated with had been sexually abused as children, almost from their first memory on forward. And most of the people in their lives, they don't trust, they're abusive, and so they've never really known. I was the first person they ever met who'd been married.
Wow.
Who had children with the man I was married with. That was a new idea for them, and so on. They were all mothers, right? And so as one of these young women told me, who was trying very hard for not the first time to break free of substance abuse, said, I'm not trying to find myself. I'm trying to create myself. Because there was no time in her life when she had sort of a loving, what I would think of as sort of a normal life. It's always been a life of crisis and abuse and so on. And she really wanted that, but she didn't even know what it would be like. And so she had to sort of invent it. And my insight was, that's what I'm trying to do too, but not, I'm not fighting interior demons. I'm fighting the oil and gas industry,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And we have always lived with oil and gas. We've always lived with fossil fuels. And they abuse us, and they're tyrannical, and they buy off our political leaders and think they can just run over our communities and have their way with us. And we're so used to taking that, that when we try to imagine a future without oil and gas, a carbon-free future, we can't find the path to that. We have to create it for ourselves because we don't know what that would be like.
That's an interesting insight. You know, you also said that jail was a spiritual experience for you, and you wrote many letters, you know. Talk to us about the spiritual experience. That was obviously part of it, that realization that...
Well, sure. And so I think jail is one of the few places that is really unfamiliar to us. You know, nobody live tweets from jail. You know, they're not... We see movies, but they're mostly about prison, which is a very different thing. Mm-hmm. And so jail, actually, you have a lot of privacy. You have your own cell. And so isolation is your main experience. And so without internet access, you know, you're lucky if you even have a pencil and paper. Those are hard to come by. You're kind of thrown back into your own thoughts. You have plenty of time. And in fact, doing time is actually literally what you're doing. I mean, time is then freed from the clock, you know, so you're untethered from time. You're eating it, drinking it, you're breathing time. You have all the time in the world now to think these very long thoughts, to kind of reflect. And I think that's intentional. You know, part of the jail experience is to reflect on your actions and so forth. But being there as a civil disobedient, I felt myself in the long line of people, including Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi, and Susan B. Anthony had been imprisoned, actually, for the crime of trying to vote in a presidential election. And so,
and I know a lot of people were jailed during the Vietnam War.
And of course, right, and of course the anti-nuclear work and drone work. And so, so you sort of feel yourself in this long chain of people, and now, through your absence and through your, and I live a very public life now as a sort of scientist in the public interest. So my silence now is how I was speaking. Suddenly, you know, the fact that I wasn't in the media, that I wasn't blogging and doing all the things that I do, that was kind of my message.
You were probably assigned a number even, right?
Yes, so I became a number. But living in this kind of ugly, diminished world of jail, cut off from the natural world, no natural light, no birdsong, all the things that are important to me, you know, the feeling of kind of half-frozen November earth under my feet, all those things are taken from you. And so the longing that you have for just the simplest things of the smell of melting snow. It becomes this acute, and you realize how much you need it. And so we are living now in the middle of a mass species extinction. Half of the wildlife that was alive when I was born, and I'm 55, are gone. The world is half alive than it used to be. Half of all bird species are on their way to extinction. 45% of invertebrates are already gone. So when you go to jail and you're living without, I didn't see another species the whole time I was there, except for other people, except there was one day we were out on the rec yard, which was just a patch of asphalt surrounded by walls and razor wire, where there was an earthworm that had worked up through the cracks. And I held it in my hand and I wept, you know, just for this. Here was the rest of creation. And that's the world that we're going to, the whole world is going to turn into jail for our children.
But,
right?
But it sounds to me like a feeling of silent spring, which is what...
Well, that metaphor is still...
The metaphor of silent spring.
We might Carson, have avoided it because we banned DDT, but in a much larger way because of climate change, not only spring will be silent, but all the other three seasons as well, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So in terms of the substance of climate change, I feel that it is, you know, the moral imperative of our time. And just looking at the evidence, it's clearly the number one threat to our children. So as the mother of a child at this moment in history, the science tells us we have about 20 years to turn this around, to decarbonize very rapidly. Mm. After that point, we kind of hit these landmines in the road, and the damage becomes permanent. Like, no matter what we do after that point, we can't rein this back in.
Yeah, well, some people are saying that it's happening right now, that we don't have 20 years
to return the earth within human lifetimes to what it was even when you or I were born. But if we do nothing, we're talking about something really calamitous, where civilization, things like pollination systems won't work anymore, agriculture won't work anymore. You know, the things that are really the foundation of our lives are going to be dysfunctional now. And so it's never too late. We can always salvage something that we couldn't salvage if we ignored it. So I feel this moral imperative now to work very intensely on this. And of course, my anti-fracking work is part of that larger project.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you wrote a letter from jail about your son calling you a crappy mom.
Yes, I did.
And that fracking made you a crappy mom. To tell us how this has taken the toll on you personally. I know it's been an incredible experience as well to try to fight for the planet, obviously. But what about the personal experience?
Right. Well, you know, I don't want to make too much of this. So I wrote that as a call to arms to other parents, because out of my experience of being out there on the front lines of the anti-fracking movement and fighting with my whole heart, like so many other people are doing. I'm not out there by myself. Mm-hmm. You know, there are people who have taken out second mortgages on their homes, who are taking everything in their bank account and buying a ticket on the bus to Albany to come rally with us, you know, and who are setting aside plans for graduate school and having families. And because they see that all bets are off, you know, if we fracture this place. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just one of many who has, whatever plans I might have had for myself, it's like, we're not doing that because this is an emergency. And we have, you know, we're called to this, we have to do what's required, to use the phrase of Winston Churchill. And so I was going to do what was required to ban fracking. And amazingly, we seem to have done it. But the surreal experience was then coming back from a rally, a public testimony, pulling an all-nighter to yet again to finish the footnotes on this big compendium of studies, whatever it is I was doing. I miss out on a lot of my children's growing up, including, you know, their theatrical performances, their cross-country championship races. You know, I'm not the mom who's there. Mm-hmm. And so to then suddenly race back home from Albany, where I just did a press conference and I just laid out the evidence and went to the governor's office and or I debated the oil and gas industry, and then suddenly there I am at the parent-teacher meeting, and I'm listening to other parents talk about SAT prep and what they're going to do for their vacation and some new craft project. And it's always jarring, because it's like, don't you know there's a war going on? Yeah, and it's not a war that we're fighting with weapons. You know, we're using nonviolence, civil disobedience, and data and facts. You know, we're marshalling all these things. Mm-hmm. And it's a war between the fossil fuel industry that's going to continue to have its way with us until we crash the planet, and those of us who say we have another future in mind and we're going to dismantle this and build something else. And so to live and breathe that and then hang out with parents who don't seem to know that that's even happening So I wanted to say, you know, we need more crappy moms to be good moms. You have to be a crappy mom. You know, you have to like not do the bake sale for the sports team. And I need you on the front lines over here.
So you're thinking about your children's future, obviously.
Well, that's all I think about, right? That's my job. I mean, I'm tasked with planning for their future and making sure it's safe and making sure that they're safe in the present. And I can't do that. I can't even be a good parent if the fossil fuel industry is going to fill my children's environment up with toxic chemicals. Mm-hmm. And those same chemicals are going to fill up the air, the atmosphere with heat-trapping gases and crash the climate system. I cannot be a good parent in that context. So I have to leave my kids to go off and change the political reality mm-hmm. and change the context here. And I don't think that's unusual in human history. It might be unusual for us in this generation.
I don't think it's unusual either.
I mean, people in the French Resistance, they had to take their kids and hide them away and not see them for years, right?
Anybody who gets involved with a fight for human rights, everybody has had to do this. I mean,
I think so.
Honestly,
I mean, Martin Luther King Jr. had a whole house full of kids, right?
Yeah.
And the people in the abolitionist movement right here in New York State who lived in some of these old houses, they must have had a house full of kids. And they still did things like help runaway slaves, even though they knew if they went to prison, they would be separated from their children for a long time. Yeah. So there must be a model for this, you know, and I'm really seeking
that's going to be your next book. That should be your next book.
Maybe so.
We only have a few minutes left. I know I have talked to a lot of people about not allowing people to lose hope. And so most people are not going to be as committed as you are. What can people do and feel hopeful and not feel like anything they do isn't going to matter?
Well, to be hopeful, you have to be as committed as I am. So the hope lies in action. Mm-hmm. You know, the antidote to despair and cynicism is to fight with your whole heart. So I always tell people, go out there with everything you have and fight with your whole heart and do it for a year and then come back and tell me nothing will change. You know, look, we all just did that for the last 3 years. And we just banned fracking in New York. So don't tell me that people can't fight really hard and win. David just slew Goliath, and we did it with a slingshot made of science and a slingshot made of love, and we prevailed. So this can be done, which is why now I've turned my attention to Seneca Lake. So to kind of circle back around to why what got me to jail was a decision not just made by me, but by hundreds of people. In fact, we have more than 1,000 people right here in the Finger Lakes who have signed a pledge to protect Seneca Lake through up to and including acts of civil disobedience. And so what this means now is that Seneca Lake, which is being rapidly turned into a gas station for the storage of fracked gas brought in from out of state, under Seneca Lake are these ancient salt caverns left over from generations of salt mining. And now this salt facility is owned, kind of occupied, under occupation by a gas company from Houston who wants to turn it into a depot for gas storage. So we are using our bodies to stand against that. And that kind of commitment sometimes is what's required. And it's actually happening. It's taking off. So
now,
we are Seneca Lake.
This is a great example of going out there and fighting and winning. And that gives people great hope. Sandra Steingraber, we're almost out of time. Are you working on any books? Can you give us some contact information as well?
Yeah, well, I'm gathering string on this whole story about how people, together with science, can fight against the fossil fuel industry. So that's in kind of that's where I'm casting my nets for my next book. Mm-hmm. But I'm really chronicling and sending dispatches now for We Are Seneca Lake. That's the name of this nonviolent civil disobedience uprising on Seneca Lake. And so my writings, you'll see them up at the website, weareSenecaLake.com.
That's great. Well, Sandra Steingraber, thank you so much. Congratulations. You have done so much for all of us. We really appreciate it.
Well, congratulations and thanks to all the people of New York who made it possible. And thanks, Dish.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.